Hey Shu, we're back. First episode 2021, and we're doing it real big to start off with, brother. We're doing it real big because we have my friend and colleague, Derek A. Hughes. Please say the A. It's important. Don't forget the A. Derek A. Hughes is a veteran TV writer. He is a member of the WGA board, the Writers Guild of America board. So this is a guy who has a lot of insight into the industry, both in practical writing experience, but also in behind the scenes industry experience. And I want to get into all of it today.
It's a great way to start off, man. We're going to have a run of guests here at the top of 21. And I think this is just a great way to start off. I'm excited.
Me too. Hit the music. Yo. Welcome to the Diversity Hires, where Sherman Shu shoot the shit about screenwriting.
We are two professional film and television writers living and working in Los Angeles, and we come here every week from year to year, 2020 into 2021, to give you the lowdown on the business, the culture, and of course, the craft of writing for film and television from a distinctly Black point of view. I am Shukri Hassan Tillman.
Now here's a funky introduction of how nice I am. Tell your mother, tell your father, send a telegram. You know who it is. The living embodiment of the courier font. The greatest screenwriter of all time, AKA G Swope. It's your boy, Sherman Payne. Sherman Payne. Yeah, 2021.
The end of it sounded like I was supposed to come in with another Sherman Payne. Like you said, Sherman Payne. I was supposed to come in like Sherman Payne.
You really you should. Know what I mean? You like, should really. You,
damn.
You should really start dropping ad libs. You should really start dropping ad libs during my introduction. Like, you know, just like a puffy style ad lib, just like in the middle of it. Take that, take that, take that. You should do it.
Just a pop. Just a pop. You know, and just it should just be like, you know, to keep it close to the podcast, it should just be like, you know, screenwriting terms, like
fade in, motherfucker, fade in.
Fade in.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Interior.
Back to.
Cut to. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Ellipsis. What?
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 Love it.
I like it.
Parenthetical, like it. parenthetical.
Bland exposition. We ain't got no bland exposition. Anyway, all right. Yeah, total nerd style. That's great for this episode.
Yes. You know, we're gonna get to him in a second. I forgot to say in the intro, this homie that we're talking to today, Derek A. Hughes, is a self-proclaimed blurred, which he'll explain at some point. But that is, of course, if you don't know already, a Black nerd. And one of the things I love about Derek is he's a cool ass guy, man. I've seen him roll around in the Tesla, like, you know, he just really got it. But he also does not hide his affinity for geek culture, for genre, for comics and superhero movies and all of the above. So I want to, you know, I know we have a lot of people who listen to this who probably count themselves in that category too. So I want to jump into all of the above. But before we do that, Shu, how are you doing?
I'm good, man. When this airs, this will be the beginning of 2021.
Yes.
And, you know, here in the beginning of 2021, I feel like I woke up and to a new day, even though it's just the passage of time, mm-hmm. You know, the things that were going on in 2020 are still going on.
Yes.
Of course, the pandemic, of course, I mean, Lord, if I have to keep reading about Black people being shot by the police, I'm going to lose my mind. And that is still going on. We could get into that or not, but all that is still going on. But even with that, New Year's is my favorite holiday of the whole year. And I love it because it's not tied to any particular cultural or religious practice or group, mm-hmm. or tradition. It is simply the celebration of the passage of time. Mm-hmm. And with the passage of time, also comes the opportunity to really like start anew. And even though it is just a calendar and it's sort of a fiction, but I like that. And so I, you know, I woke up in 2021 feeling like I was renewed and, you know, ready to begin, ready to hit the ground running and hit my resolutions.
Okay. So that, first of all, that's very, very eloquent. So nothing to say there. I'm curious. Not
that's just how I talk.
That's I know. That's how you talk in normal conversation. That's how you talk over text. Yeah. It's like this shoe is still going. Oh my God, this text is 5 pages. But what I was gonna say is, okay. So I don't care about resolutions, but what I do care about is what are your goals as a writer? This is a screenwriting podcast. What are your goals in 2021? What do you want to get done in the new year that you did not accomplish in 2020? And listen, be honest. Let the people really know what you're aspiring to.
Don't take this the wrong way.
Okay.
Well, I know. Actually, I know you're not going to take this the wrong way.
I hope you're about to say what I think you're about to say.
My aspiration is to be the motherfucking best.
Talk that's my aspiration. That shit, bro.
My aspiration is to be the best. My only challenge is really when I wake up, my real opponent is the person in on the other side of the mirror.
Oh my God, you're so deep.
So my only challenge, is really, and that's for all of us, really. No, all bullshit aside.
Yeah.
For all of us as writers, I think our, you know, we're not in competition with each other.
Yes, we are.
Our real. You are.
I am in competition with everybody. Nobody. All of you guys are my. All everybody's ops. All I see is ops.
Yeah. All right. Fine. But our challenge, Our challenge is really, you know, ourselves. Our challenge is really sort of like, you know, what are we going to do with ourselves to become better? To become better writers? Mm-hmm. To read more? To execute better? To get the fundamentals of the craft down even more, to experience more, to become more versatile, whatever it is, to produce more, to become more prolific, whatever it is. That's what it takes to be the best, and that's what I'm aiming to do.
Love it. I love it. I thought maybe what you were going to say is, I've already accomplished everything I need to accomplish. I'm just waiting for the industry to catch up. That would have been dope. But also just trying to be the best is dope too. I mean, I don't want to belabor this point, but like in terms of concrete goals, I've been really thinking that, man, this is the year that I really want to get a show off the ground. I want to get a TV show off the ground. You know, maybe not off the ground, but I would like to keep progressing and getting further and further in the process, because TV development, as we all know, is one of many different steps and benchmarks, right? Like just getting somebody to hire you to write the pilot is a benchmark. And then just getting that sold to a potential network or distributor or streamer or whatever is another benchmark. And then getting them to commit to make a pilot is another benchmark. And then getting, you know, so there's all these benchmarks that go into TV development. I want to just reach new heights, you know, and I hope that it culminates in a show that gets produced and makes it to the air. But I also want to keep going further and further and reach new benchmarks that I haven't reached. And the second thing I want to
I think that's
go ahead.
Oh
no, please.
No, I think that's gonna happen for you. I think you should tell the people your news, man, if it's kosher to share.
What news?
Your showrunner training program news.
Oh. Yes, I have
been. I mean, that's a big part of that first goal, which I think is
I have been invited to participate in the showrunner training program, which I'm very excited about. So I will that's something I don't know anything about it yet. We have not had the first session, so as I learn from that and as I take that course, which is a great course, it's just invite only. It's an application process.
The WGA sponsor.
Through the WGA. Then I will keep people updated on what I learn and what I don't. But yeah, that's a big thing. And the other thing I want to do, Shu, is I've said it before on here that I'm a movie guy. You know, I mean, I love television. It's been so fun working in TV. I've learned a lot about myself as a writer. I've learned a lot about how production works. But really, deep down in my heart, I really just want to write 90 minutes to 120 minutes of just one story. That's really where my heart is. So I really would like to write another movie and hopefully get it made sometime this year. So those are my goals that I'm setting for myself. I'm really trying. I'm already working hard on them. We'll see if they come true.
That's what's up. That's all great stuff, man.
Yes,
that's
sir.
I think the show thing's gonna happen.
I hope so.
I have a feeling.
I hope so.
Yeah. It might not be in calendar year 2021 literally, mm-hmm. but you know, it might just be set up so that it's happening. But I feel that for you. That's my psychic, you know, Miss Cleo talk for you.
Well, my second goal is that you get a show and just hire me as like a really high ranking writer in the room. That's my second goal. My second goal is actually a goal for you.
It's a job that you could be.
Well, it's a job, but yeah, it's also one that, like, I'm your friend, so I won't feel so bad about blowing off deadlines, turning in late work, turning in subpar work, not attending production meetings, ignoring your emails and texts. It'll make all that much easier. It's harder when you're when you're employed by somebody you don't know to be your lazy
That's
self.
That's true. I think that it's also like if your friend, I mean, it's kind of, it could be fucked up, but if your friend is running the room, you can kind of be like, what the fuck are we doing?
You know what? I actually wish that, you know, I wonder if that is, well, this is a good place to bring Derek into because I'm sure he has some experience. Yeah. But like, you know, I wonder if that might actually help a room dynamic in a way where you could just say to the showrunner, nah, fam, no.
Word. Like, really? Is this... Come on, are we doing that? You know, is this really the story we're going with? Is this it?
Yeah.
You know, you can have a back and forth. Like, what? What's wrong with it?
No, I mean, like in real talk, because you know, you're always pulling your punches with a boss. Like, and hopefully you have a boss that gets it right 9 times out of 10. But sometimes you're like, what are we doing? And you can't really say what's going on. Shoot, I don't want to take up too much time talking about ourselves because we have a guest today that I really want to. Do a deep dive into his backstory and what he's got going on. So I want to invite my man, Derek A. Hughes, to join the convo. Derek, are you there, brother?
Let's see. Am I? I can't tell because this microphone doesn't seem to be working, but I mean.
No, you are here.
Yeah, you're here.
Or maybe I'm just intimidated to walk into a room filled with so much greatness. I mean, good Lord. And it's like, y'all sure you didn't bring in a hype man for this?
Derek, you have to be your own hype man. You have to be your own hype man in this world. Nobody's going to do it for you.
Sir, if that's one thing I've known about you since the day I first met you, I knew that you're own hype man. There's no doubt about that.
Yo, let me tell you something. Where I met Derek was actually Shakri. I don't know even know if we talked about this. Where I met Derek was my first ever. I had done a TV show before, but there was no real room. Right, it was an anthology, so every writer was off on their own. And I met Derek in my first real television staffing experience. And Derek was a great guy to have in the room, man. But I'll let Derek tell me what his impressions of the young G-Swole were.
My first impression was like, not only was you on your own hype man, but I was just like, if writers had their own battles, like if the showrunner said, all right, today we're going to battle. He'd be the first to leap up and be like, let's go. Let's do this.
Yes. 100%.
Well, I could go page for page, scene for scene. Exactly. Is that what it is?
No, I would have. I definitely would have done that.
Flashback.
But Derek. So first of all, how have you been doing during this sort of perilous time? Mm-hmm. I know that you've been working pretty steadily through the entire pandemic and quarantine, but how you feeling?
Well, look, man, I mean, you know, it's like everybody else, it's hard not to feel numb after a while to make sure that you actually have emotions and feelings, especially, especially, for those of us that live alone, right? It's one thing if you have a significant other or, you know, just, or roommates or something like that, that you're in a pod with, but, you know, it's a whole other thing where it's just like where you're on an intimate level with your TV, iPad, laptop day in and day out. Right. So, you know, it's like, and then again, like I was saying earlier about trying not to doom scroll every day, but you know, we are in the dumpster fire of 2020 coming, you know, and going in hopefully into a more optimistic year.
Yes.
I would want to say, Sherm, congratulations on getting selected to the showrunners training program, because that is a very, very tough program. My writing partner and I which you didn't mention, but I mean, that's, I can get into that later. My writing partner and I, we got accepted into the program last year after, you know, we applied a couple of times in the past. Mm-hmm. And so we got, but I can't say that I'm an alum because our last class, which was supposed to happen, our last two classes got shut down right as the pandpocalypse started happening, where the shutdown happened. And so we couldn't meet in person. And they didn't want to do the disservice of having us over Zoom at that point in time, because there were just so many things of, like, you know, it's a full day of bringing in different writers and different people that have, levels of expertise in there, including, one of the earlier ones was your boss. I don't know if he's still your boss or former boss, Mr. John Wells.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Who spoke very highly of you. Ben and I were like, oh yeah, we work with Sherm. He goes, ah, Sherman. He's like, love him.
Shout out John Wells. That is also Shakri's boss.
And that is, and I could say that is his reaction when Sherman Payne's name gets mentioned. It is exactly that.
You're gonna make me blush. Sherman. You're gonna make me blush.
The plan is for Jeff Melvoin and Carol Kirshner are the instructors to try to pick it up sometime next year. I'm thinking it's probably going to be more realistic, like 2022. And, when we can all gather in person to close out. So it was weird because, the two classes that we didn't get to do was the all day financial sort of like a seminar that Mr. Wells does. It's a legendary apparently class where he comes in and talks about really getting into the nuts and bolts of the figuring out budgets and tracking all that stuff that I've only heard on the periphery, but some people that have been so impressed by it that they've actually come back to take that class specifically to help them out. Mm-hmm. Because, it's like, if anything, what you're going to come to discover, and also you guys do your observations, is like when you do become a showrunner, it is you're basically managing 300 cats in a burlap sack. It is controlled chaos. It's like every time you think that you have, it's about waking up every morning and talking about what fires can I, do I have to put out today? What fires can I prevent from having to put out today? Mm-hmm. It's managerial at its highest level, because you're basically sort of like running a company with 300 plus employees. And, it's like a friend of ours, he always said that it was sort of like the equivalent of you starting up your own company and the studios are the banks, right? And the studios are saying, like, here's $150 million, $200 million. Now go make my product and make my product on time. It's like, okay.
Yes. And on budget.
And so on budget. And that's what, the showrunner training program, allows people to sort of get a better idea, because some people don't get that experience. And then all of a sudden they're thrown into the deep end of the pool and they crash and burn, right? Yeah, it's like when we applied for the program, I think there was, it's like they select, 28 writers? And then I think there was over 160 applicants.
Yeah.
So, and I can only imagine this year is probably even more so. Yeah, so again, you're sort of in that rarefied air of like getting into those programs. This really means that, you impressed enough people and you have something where it's like, because they only select people that they feel are either about to have their own show or have their own show or something like that. Ben and myself, we were at that point in time, we had two potential shows that we were developing. So that's how high the bar is of trying to get into the program.
Because you're also competing with everybody is an established writer. Like, you can't even apply unless you have several seasons of television or unless you're about to make a show. So I feel honored about that. And I'm going to keep updating the listenership on how it goes as it happens. But I don't want to take up too much time on that, because I really want to hear and Shu, I don't know if you have a question first, but I was just going to ask Derek to sort of take us through his early story. Like, tell us about coming up all the way to the point when you met your writing partner, Ben, who we both know and love. And yeah, let me, you know, tell us your whole journey, man. Give us the the 5-minute version, the 10-minute version of like how you got to where you are.
Well, the truncated version, because it is a long version and we ain't about to do a mini series here. the truncated version would be I was born in Japan. My mother's Japanese. My father is black from Philly. They met right after the Vietnam War, right during the Vietnam War. Married 2 years later, had me. I was born in Tokyo. Being a military brat, traveled around the world. Traveled various, different parts of the United States. And finally came back to California after living in the Philippines and Okinawa, and then coming back to California, where I was able to spend my teenage years, my adolescent years in Central California. And then from there, I had my first love, which was sports, was like basketball. And then I discovered that I had an affinity for track and field, and especially the hurdles. And I was really good. I was ranked top 3 in Northern California. But where I wasn't good, and this is, haunts me to this day, is my love of studying, my love of being a student. And I made some poor choices. I chose to party with my friends more than study. And because of that, it hurt my chances of getting, any chances of getting any scholarships or, getting into college anywhere other than my, my small hometown. But I realized that was not the path for me. Once I discovered I could go into the military, I was like, oh, okay, I'm following my father's footsteps. And the next thing I knew, I was, part of the few, the proud, in as we call it, Hotel San Diego, training to become a Marine. And the other sort of carrot, dangling carrot, was, hey, it's like you can keep running track because the Marine Corps has a track team, and you can compete on against other military branches. I was like, oh, cool. So that was kind of where I, had a goal. And that's one of the things my father and my parents just instilled in me, when his kids was, and you always hear about that. You always, just like, you put, whatever you put your mind to, you can do. And I think that's so important, is having, parental figures, and there's somebody, a mentor, somebody that, can instill that in use, at a very early age, not to the point where, it's like the participation trophy, it's not like that, which is kind of, as we're discovering has had a tremendous sort of blowback, and there's been problems there, but, it's just, again, instilling enough of, believe and you can achieve, and, and just really find something that you're passionate about. And so track and field was something I was very passionate about, and I was very good. But after I blew out my hamstring, that forced me to sort of like reevaluate as like, okay, there was a joke, and I think it was the comedian. I never forgot it. I think it was a comedian by the name of Franklin Ajaya. And it was this joke about this guy was saying, like, what goes through the mind of the guy that's in last place at the Olympics? He's like sitting there as he's running saying, like, man, I'm in last place. I trained for 4 years and I'm in last place. He's like, hell, I could have not have trained for 4 years and still be in last place.
And that's so funny.
And I was in that same boat where I was like, okay, do I really want to train for another 4 years and try to get to a place where I know that it's probably going to be impossible and I'm going to be older? And it's like, not like I was ancient or anything. I was like, I'm 23 at the time. 26 maybe. And then, it's just like, but I was like, I'm done. I'm going to show it. And so at that point in time, it was around my, cause when I was in college, you pick your majors and what you think you want to do. Right. But college is also that time where you've really start to figure out who you are as a person. But I already had that sort of advantage because unlike most of my peers, I had lived a life, being a Marine, being in the military. Mm-hmm. and figuring out what I wanted to do versus, you know, not wanting to do with my life to a certain degree. So by the time that I got into college, everybody else, you know, around me felt like they were always in an urgent way of like trying to like rush. I got to get through here so I can get out in the real world. And I was like, whoa, slow down. You don't want to get out there. Real world's crazy.
I've been there.
It's like crazy.
I've been there.
Do you understand?
I've been there. You don't want to. Slow down, like, young man.
Slow down. Yeah. Like I am here just walking around on the campus, enjoying my life, talking to beautiful women, learning things, eating food that I want to eat, all this stuff, and then going to practice every day. It's like, y'all are crazy if you want to go out there, you know? And
you want to go pay bills? Come on.
Pay bills. It's like the only, you know, it was that sort of thing where, so halfway through college, I switched my major because I was a foreign language major and with a, mm-hmm. you know, exploration. I say exploration in the vaguest of terms of you know, taking on a second major of international business. Uh-huh. Only one problem. Well, obviously two problems. It was one, I didn't want to do any business. And I, you know, and then as far as like foreign language, I was studying Japanese and I was like, well, I don't want to teach. I don't want to do any business. I really don't want to go back to Japan right now. So I was like, what am I doing? And thankfully, when I switched my major, because I took a screenwriting course on a whim, the professor said, you have so much natural talent. I think you're really wasting your time. And again, going back to the whole thing of like, well, since I've already been out there, I know what to do, what not to, you know, what I want to do. So I switched my major. And sure enough, you know, it was reflected in my interests of like, you know, my GPA went from like a 2.6 to a 3.6. And right. I was just, you know, fully engaged in a way of like all those endless hours of watching television and movies. You know, I didn't realize that I can actually apply it towards something. So, you know, after I blew my hamstring in 2000, I moved in with my best friend in Santa Monica, getting back on my feet. And so the one thing, you know, was like, okay, if I'm gonna really sort of like figure this out, I got to start working for the entertainment industry. So mm-hmm. I started out as a PA working over on the Paramount lot on a couple of shows. And it was there that that eventually led to a chance encounter. My best friend and I went to, once upon a time, in Los Angeles, they used to have a comic book convention every last Sunday of the month. It was called the LA Comic Book Convention. It was held at the Shrine Auditorium. Mm-hmm. And so my best friend and I, we would go. And then this particular Sunday, they were showing a preview of the first X-Men trailer. And so I went there and, you know, trying to watch it. It was so crowded. And I'm up there on the second level trying to get position for a good angle to watch it. And I kept bumping into this guy. And we were either going to come to blows or we're going to talk. And it was like, so eventually, you know, I turned out like talked to him, and turned out that he had just moved out here from Washington, D.C. To start writing on a new sci-fi show. And I knew the sci-fi show, and it was called Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda, starring Kevin Sorbo. And I was like, oh, hey, so I did the thing that, you know, a lot of people.
So you're not going to fight him. You're not going to punch him.
You're not going to fight him. You're not going to fight because I recognize the show, and, you know, we got to talk in. And I did the thing that you're not supposed to do, or, you know, some people say you're not supposed to do, but at the same time, I didn't know that rule. So I said, fuck it. I said, hey, man, I'm studying to be a writer. You know, I've been writing, working on scripts, and, you know, I would love, you know, if you had a moment, to read something of mine. And he's actually agreed. He was like, send me what you got. And he read it. He read it, called me up, and he said, let's meet for dinner. And so it was in the Valley, and I went out to the Valley and met him. And he sat down and we said, look, I read your script. And he said, I see there's no reason why you can't make it in this business. And he said, but I'm going to impart three things, you know, unto you. And, you know, to this day, I've taken those three things. Not only, you know, I constantly sort of apply them to myself, but I tell any young writer or just writer, you know, that anybody that's interested in writing and wanting to get into this business, these three important things that have, you know, served me well. And it's the one, you know, the first thing is write something.
If you, yes. And, you say know, it again.
And you know, two, if you're not writing something, then you're reading something. And the mm-hmm. third and most important lesson of them all, finish things. Yeah, and that
it should be a bumper sticker, Derek.
Right?
Yeah.
That
yeah.
in itself is like the, I think, like, you know, it's such an important lesson, you know, that where you would, I think that's, you know, that separates writers from people that just say they want to write.
Yep.
Yes. I want to use that. That's great.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I always say on this podcast, I think all of us, and really whatever industry you're in or trying to do, even if it is like track and field or something, all of us run into sort of like, you know, mentors or angels along the way to sort of give us that piece, that little thing that we need to sort of push us to the next phase of our career or of our endeavor. So it leads me to the question of like, and maybe this is a little bit of a skip ahead, but at what, because when we all start first writing, you know, mm-hmm. we're amateurs.
Yep.
And so at what point do you start to feel in your journey, is it before this meeting or after this, that like, I can become a professional mm-hmm. and I need to try to figure out how to break in? When did that happen, and what was the first break in? What was the first sort of like paid thing?
The first moment that was like, it was, I mean, during that same sort of conversation, he, you know, threw the cold water in my face. He goes, "All right, I read your screenplay and you said you want to write movies. Here's the reality." He says, "You have a better chance of winning the lotto twice before you sell that screenplay, much less see that screenplay up on the big screen." And he says, "If you want to have a career in writing, look into writing for television." And, you know,
solid. Let me tell you something. Solid advice. Yeah. I've said it before on this yeah. podcast that, you know, I have been fortunate enough to get something to the screen as a movie, but that if I could go back and sort of start my career over again, I would have put a lot more effort into television instead yep. of spending all those years, quite frankly, spinning my wheels trying to get a movie off the ground.
Yep. Especially, you know, it's like for, you know, people, for people of color, it's like we're, yeah. You know, it's like, yeah. it's a whole other ball of wax of obstacles that you have to get mm-hmm. through. So, you know, you gotta, it's like, you know, video games, right? You gotta learn the cheat codes. What's the cheat codes? Well, in this case, it's like, oh, okay, right for television. And so this very, you know, same person, he reached out to me about 6 months later saying like, "Hey, the writer's assistant on the show mm-hmm. is leaving. I think you have a really good shot at getting, mm-hmm. you know, getting the gig." So I said, "All right," I went in, and to this day, I think it was like one of the most daunting interviews I've ever been, because it wasn't just the mm-hmm. showrunner that I was meeting with, it was like the entire writing staff. And it was almost like a little tribunal, right? You walk in and they're all sitting there in a crescent shaped, you know, just of chairs. And you know, it's like you're sitting in the center of it. And, you know, the only thing that was missing was robes. And, and you know, and they're asking you questions and all that. But after the interview, you know, the showrunner, who to this day is a dear friend of mine, Mr. Robert Wolf, mm-hmm. he, you know, ended up hiring me. And this is, you know, to go back to your question there, Shu, is that mm-hmm. I discovered that in working as a writer's assistant for this one show, my writing went from my understanding of writing and just writing in general went from like you can't see, you know what I'm saying, but it's like almost like, you know, my hands put together to like my hands apart type of, you know, sort of you know, gulf of like shoulder width apart type of thing, right?
Yeah.
Where in a 6 month period, I was like understanding things so much and just getting a better sense of land in a way that you just don't get from the outside looking in. It's just all the more reason why, you know, I encourage people to you know, if you want to get into this business, you got to learn how this business works. You got to learn how, you know, and that's whether, you know, getting as a writer's PA, writer's assistant, but, you know, those jobs are so hard to get. But I say that. Yeah.
I'm sorry, Derek. No, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Nah,
but
go ahead. It's your show. I'm just a guest.
You should shut me off, right?
Cut his mic right now.
Right? Cut his mic.
You want to see how great we are? You want to see?
I just want to interject for a second because we do talk a lot about sort of ways in, and I'm sure we have a lot of listeners who are aspiring, and we always try to cater to them a little bit.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, and not even just for the aspiring, for all of us, like, when you say you learn from being an assistant, I was never an assistant. I don't think Sherman was ever a writer's assistant. We didn't go that route.
Yep.
Not because we didn't want to necessarily, but we just didn't happen.
Yeah.
So when you say your writing became better and the gulf became sort of like, you know, you learned so much over that 6 month period, what do you mean exactly? Is it sitting in the room listening to the pitches? Is it, because I always hear people say, like, you need to learn the business. Yeah. But what does that mean? Are we talking about like the craft of hearing people pitch? What it takes to make a television show?
You know, it's like from nuts to bolts, from person coming in saying like, I have an idea for this episode. Here's the idea. And then listening, watching the showrunner say like, okay, I like that idea, but what if we did this? How about if we do this? Okay, now let's talk about these characters and see where this character's emotional journey is going to be over this course of this episode, where our big moments are, how do we afford to even do this episode? And then, you know, you start breaking it out beat by beat. And then, so for me, it's like the writer's assistant. Not only am I taking the notes, but I'm also writing on the board because Robert encourages, because Robert came from the school of Roddenberry, right? It's like Robert, you know, his first experience was like selling a freelance episode. You know, one of my early favorite episodes, it was called A Fistful of Datas. And for any of the, again, my blurs out there, it was where Worf and his son go to the holodeck and then the holodeck malfunctions and they're trapped in a Western. And the Western and all the characters start to turn into like Data, the android. Uh-huh. And so, you know, it's like, it's fun, right? So Robert sold that, you know, that pitch, that episode, and he got to write it. And then from there, his like career got to, you know, take off to the point where he moved over to Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And, but coming from that, where they did 26 episodes a season, you know, he saw the benefits and the sort of the encouragement of like, you know, bringing in freelance writers, giving them a shot. And so it was always the sort of pay it forward mentality. So, you know, Robert, one of the things that he said was like, as you know, I was working on the show and learning how, you know, to become a writer myself. In that point in time, that's where I also met my writing partner. As I call it, our geek cute. I met him in a comic book store, and again, almost to a point where, you know, it was like we were either going to fight or we were going to talk because I insulted one of his best friends. This is how it happens for Derek.
Yeah, by the way, exactly. This is a pattern has emerged.
Yeah, man. It's a thin line between fighting and a career partnership.
Yeah,
like, very thin line with Derek.
When I first met Sherm on the show, I was like, "Where are you from, bro?"
No, wait. You know what? The funny thing is, let me tell you something. This is why Derek straddles so many different worlds. Obviously, you guys are getting the handle that Derek has had many different lives, and it goes through many different cultures, military culture, geek culture, all and everything in between.
But sports,
all of it. But the reason why I messed with Derek when I first met him is, I walked in and I saw this other writer who was wearing a pair of crispy white Jordan 2s. And I'll never forget that actually made me feel so comfortable. I was just like, oh, okay. No, seriously. I was like, okay, so it's not, you know, because as a new staff writer, you don't know what to expect. You don't know what the culture is going to be like, especially as a Black writer. You don't know if you're going to come into an environment where you just feel totally out of place. And I know a lot of Black writers had that experience. But just walking in there and seeing my man Derek with the Jordan 2s, cool guy from Cali, it really did actually put me at ease quite a bit. So,
but there was no fighting. No, but the rest of the story was then Sher had to flex a shoe game And that brother had like different pair of shoes on every other week. I was like, man, how are you married? How do you have a family? How do you afford it on a staff writer? I don't understand any of this. This doesn't make any sense.
You know what? Because my wife liked to keep me in that drip. She liked to keep me in that drip. But yes, no, I did. Of course. The first thing of any person who likes sneakers is you see the sneakers that the other person is wearing. You respect game. You go, okay, you give them a little nod. And then you pull the heat out of the closet and try to destroy them. I interrupted.
Because
I do want to talk a little bit about, I do want to get into eventually some of your journey into the WGA board, talk to me about meeting Ben. Shout out to Ben. He's your writing partner. I know him as well. Yep. He's a great guy. Talk about meeting Ben and then how you guys formed your relationship and then doing the NBC program together.
Yeah. So I met Ben, like I said, we were, in a comic book store, and one of my favorite comic books is called Planetary. It was running 6 months late. And at this point in time, you know, you read something on the internet saying like, oh, it's there. So I race down there, pick it up. It's not there. So I become the angry fanboy inside the comic book store saying like, these lazy fucking artists, they're never on time. They're always playing video games. This is some bullshit. And Ben is quietly perusing the aisles and he's listening. And he makes it a policy never to engage with fanboys, especially angry fanboys. Why? Because Ben actually started his career in Marvel Comics. Like, he started out as an intern and then worked his way up to, you know, becoming part of a digital editor for the, you know, Marvel Online program. It was the first ever. This was back in the late 90s. And then eventually became a freelance writer, you know, went on to write such books as like The Phantom and Green Lantern, you know, for DC and a bunch of, you know, his editor on the X-Men books. So long story short, he had just moved out from New York to LA. And so here he is sitting in here listening to me. And finally he has to say something because why? Because I'm insulting one of his best friends and happened to be a groomsman at his wedding. John Cassidy, the artist, who's now a really good friend of mine now at this point in time. But, it's just like, at that point, he was like, you're absolutely wrong. It's not John's fault. It's the writer, Warren Ellis. And I'm looking at him like, and you are? And he goes, well, I'm Ben Rabb. And, you know, he's like, John, you know, he's been waiting on Warren to deliver a script. And I'm just like, okay. And he goes, well, what's your name? He was like, I'm Ben Rabb. And I'm like, oh, why did this name sound so familiar? And the comic book store goes, this is Ben Rabb. He wrote for X-Men, this book. And I looked him dead in the eye and I was like, yo, I always thought you were older and fatter, because growing up in the 80s, it was like the only comic book writers, you know, one would tend to see were sort of like these big doughy white dudes with these beards, you know, that you were like, oh yeah, there's those comic book writers, you know, and that was kind of what you pictured. And my writing partner at a point in time looking like a rock star, I was like, hold up, you're like, you're a comic book writer? So, you know, and when he found out what I did, it was his turn to sort of say like, hey, I've been looking to make a transition from comic books into film and television. I would love to pick your brain. So I was like, sure. We exchanged information and we met a week later over lunch and discovered we had so many things in common, right down to our birthdays being 3 days apart, that we just slowly started collaborating on ideas. You know, first a couple of feature ideas. We got our first representations off of two writing samples, and then we were just off to the races of like trying to break into television. It took us 8 years to break into television. In between that time, we created our own comic book series. We wrote like two different comic book series, I should say. One was like one that we created, and another one we worked with Virgin Comics and with John Woo's company. And then we got into digital media, and it was there that we got our first sort of like experience of working in a smaller writer room. We worked on a digital web series called Afterworld, which was 130 episodes at that point in time in the mid 2000s, which was unheard of. But you know, that got us, that was our first paying gig. Because in between those 8 years of juggling, you know, like you were saying, Sherman, I wore a lot of hats. I was a junior agent for a lit agency for a couple of years.
Really?
Which again, learning the other side of the business and, you know, seeing like what agents do, what, you know, what happens to, you know, when a person comes in with a script and what, you know, to get it out to the studio, get in front of a studio exec, get a person staffed or sell, you know, selling a screenplay. So I learned a lot there. But what was really cool was a smaller boutique agency, and they all knew that I was a writer first. And so I was, you know, able to, Ben and I were able to like go to meetings in the middle of the day. It was just like my old boss would just say, like, as long as you come back, it's like, you know, it's like, you're good. So, you know, I had that luxury and that, you know, the fortune of being able to maintain a job, but also, you know, continue to pursue my writing career.
All right. So Derek, it takes you guys 8 years to break in, which is a lot, but you were doing things within that. I imagine Writers on the Verge came somewhere within that or at the end of that. You know, and I'm just going by IMDb, but I'm looking at all the shows that you were a part of: Warehouse 13, Beauty and the Beast, Flash, Scream, all the way up to Arrow. And it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you're one of these television writers who got in. I mean, you started as a writer's assistant. You worked your way all the way up to the top of the sort of hierarchy. And I just wonder if you could talk about your experience kind of in a nutshell and how you have changed or adapted as a writer, especially being a writer of color in those rooms, all genre rooms, it sounds like, over time. I wonder if you could just talk about that.
Yeah, so it was near the end of those 8 years that my writing partner came to me and said, like, yo, like, we need to get serious about this, because as I always say, he's the adult in the relationship, in the partnership, because he has a wife and he has two kids. Yes. And he's got the family. And
if you know Ben, it's big time dad energy. He brings dad energy in the best possible way. Like, kind, overseeing, gently moving you towards where you need to go. Like, Ben is a good dude to have in a room.
Yeah, Ben is definitely, you know, like I said, we've been writing partners almost close to, 20 years now? It's crazy. But at that point in time, he said, like, either we had been applying for different writing programs year in and year out and getting rejected year in and year out. And we did a last hurrah where it was just sort of like, okay, this is going to work, or we're going to have to figure out something else. And at that point, it sounds like, man, I ain't got no plan B. But you know, it's like, so we applied to four of the programs and ended up getting accepted into three of them. We ended up choosing the NBC Writers on the Verge program, which was a tremendous program. The other thing was, like, it was right there on the Universal lot, and the writer's room, the writer's offices, they were all in the on the Universal lot as well. So we stayed in the program. We kept we would finish up work and then we would go over on Tuesdays and Thursdays to be a part, continue the program until we finished it up, and because we were just learning so much from it. So that,
super side note.
Yeah.
Universal is a great lot to work on.
Oh man.
It's just a great lot. It's a fantastic. That was my first show was on that lot.
Did you? Great lot to work on.
You really feel like you made it.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you always see the trams with all the tourists coming by. I had a friend when we would walk over to the cafe in the back and the trams would come by. It was like the driver got so used to seeing us that my friend started like dancing for the tourists. he would start doing like little dance for the tourists and stuff like that. It was crazy. You're walking around there, take the little golf cart, go up by the Jaws lake and the Psycho House all this stuff. Yeah, it was cool. And if you were slick about it.
Went to the theme park at lunch.
Yes, if you were slick about it, you knew how to get into the theme park. You'd be like, let's go on the Simpsons ride. Let's go, do the Transformers ride and stuff. Yes. Yeah, no, that was fantastic. That was cool.
Sorry for the detour.
That's good.
That was a good detour. Yeah.
So talk a little bit about just in general, not even specific shows, but like in general, what's it like moving through the industry as a black genre writer who writes almost specifically in genre. You've done sci-fi, you've done superhero, you've done a little bit of horror. Like, talk to me a little bit about moving through this industry as a Black writer in the genre space.
Well, one, it's you know, it is the, you got to have your specialty, or you got to, you know, sort of like, you don't want to be pigeonholed anything. Like, look, Ben and I, we could write, you know, we feel like we can write anything, but it's not so much that we could feel we could write anything. It's like what we want to write. And we're fortunate enough to be in our career now where we, like, you know, sometimes our agents, you know, our reps will be like, hey, this project, and we're like, nah, it's like, have no interest in doing that. But, you know, in navigating those worlds, of course, it's very sort of, again, having sort of the experiences and having, you know, being in, again, military background and and just knowing, you know, having sort of an awareness of what's going on around you, right? So walking into a writer's room where you're the only person of color, it's no different than just walking into a store where you notice you're the only person of color, walking through an airport where you notice you're the only person of color. You know, it's like, I never forget the first time I walked through the airport in Salt Lake City. You know, I was like, man, I'm a raisin in a bucket of rice right now. This is crazy.
You didn't see Karl Malone there? Karl Malone wasn't there.
I was like, I think Karl Malone was scheduled to come through at between 2 and 3 p.m. to make his wave of like, we got one. We got one here. But
they thought Derek was the new point guard for the
100%. 100% somebody in the Salt Lake City. Shout out to Salt Lake City if we have any listeners. But 100% they thought Derek was there to play.
Yeah.
100%.
Or workout.
It was like
I like Salt Lake City.
In 2 hours' time, I was like, I didn't see a single. I was like, what? What is this? This is crazy. I will say this, Sharma. It was until Scream where I wasn't the only only Black person in there. It was like, I was saying,
kidding?
Yeah, in the other shows, there were other people of color that, you know, but it was the only Black person, Black writer. Up until Scream. And then when I walked in and it was you and Dana and Chrissy, you know, it was like, Brett, I see what you're doing.
We got to give a big shout out to Brett Matthews, a friend of all of us individually. We've all worked with Brett. And
still working with Brett.
You still work for him on Legacies, but Brett is great, and Brett is a young showrunner himself and a white guy, but is super committed to diversity. And like, so props to Brett for using his position.
If there are any fans out there that enjoyed Scream Season 3, which was most, you know, and the most diverse cast, you know, for that show, that series, that's a large part to Brett. Brett was like, nope, we're going to shoot this in Atlanta for Atlanta. We're going to cast these people. And it was just, and you know, and then he brought all us in and we were just like, oh, okay, I see what you're doing here. And it was great. But that was like the only time where I was like, whoa, this is crazy. It was like that. So the most, you know, that I've been a part of in that way. So moving through those spaces, you're just sort of aware, but at the same time, you can't let it affect you because you don't want it to be a case of like, well, you don't have to keep turning to me to see if it's okay if a Black person says this. It's like, you don't have to give me the side eye when, you know, you think that you said something offensive. But, you know, if I do see something or, you know, I feel something's off, I'm gonna call you on it. I think, you know, this goes back to your whole thing about having those honest conversations, and you have to have those honest conversations. And I'm definitely in a place where it's like, you know, I have zero fucks to give, right? It's like, I can, you know, I can point something out, say something and say that. And I think that also, you know, there's a new cut of the younger writers that also have that feeling of empowerment. And they just, as long as they know and understand that they have the support in place, because there's others, you know, you hear other stories where it's still the same typical bullshit. and they have to sort of bite their tongue because of fear of losing their job, or, you know, this is the perception of possibly making enemies and not getting hired on the next show, you know, and stuff like that, right? There's a lot of passive aggressive type of stuff like that happens. So as, you know, your responsibility, you know, in being, you know, sort of the upper level writer and person that has had that experience, you have to keep an eye on that as well. So I think that, you know, it's different from show to show. I'm sure that you guys have had different experiences. And again, we are accustomed to that because that is just where it's like, again, walking into a store, you know that somebody has eyeballs on you already. It's like, yeah. No matter what, no matter where you go, it's like somebody's like already like questioning why you're here. And that's the one thing that, you know, you have to do is like, you always have to have a qualifier, right? You always have to be like, oh, why are you here? Oh, is it because of diversity? Were you a diversity hire? You know, yeah. It's like, oh, you're hired because you wrote a dope script. Oh, you're hired because you're actually a really good writer. Right. It's like, oh, you know, I have the sort of added, sort of like, I would say buffer protection of having a white writing partner, yeah. You know, in that way. But, you know, it's like, but there's definitely that sort of, there's still that if they don't know that I'm the writing partner, you know, sometimes people are like, how'd you get here? You know, you can right. see it in their eyes. You can see the calculation that's going on there. Right. It's like, yeah. But this, again, this is something that we are unfortunately, we're so accustomed to because we've been doing this from, you know, the time that we've learned how to talk. We've been, yeah. you know, we've had to exist in these spaces. So when we go into these writers' rooms, they're just a microcosm of the bigger world that we already exist and live in. It's just a matter of like, how do we navigate it in such a way that it doesn't draw attention and, again, doesn't feel like we're a threat. You know, we're a threat. So it's a million calculations a second every single day.
Right.
The point where it's like it just becomes subconscious and you don't even realize that you're doing it. I think that's, if there's anything, you know, to sort of like bring it back to like what you're saying of like just how to navigate in the room, it's just like you want to do enough not to rock the boat. It's like, and it's not in a sort of like, oh, yes, master sort of way. It's just sort of like, you know, that there's always going to be somebody that's going to be pressed about what you say or what you do, and they might not voice it, but they're thinking it, and it sucks. And so all you can do is just say like, you know what? I see you. I hear you. I don't give a fuck about you. I'm going to do what I need to do, and I'm going to move on. I'm going to, you know, you can't hold me back. You can't hold me down. You know, I think it goes back again to your guys of like what you're saying of like, you have to be your own PR person. You have to sell yourself. You have to do it in such a way. It is not in an arrogant way. It's just like, don't challenge me. Don't try to come for me, because I will shut you down. You know, it's like, you got to do it. You know, it's like, because that's so important to have that sort of level of confidence and knowing that it's like, oh, you might try to hurt my career. You might try to do that. But if I can show on the page and I can show that I am a person that, you know, that actually isn't what you're saying, who, you know, you, that I'm trying to be, then move on.
That's excellent advice. And I think that's a great place to leave that. Real quick, before we get into our wrap up, Derek, talk to us real quick about why you decided to run for the WGA, what you hope to accomplish on the WGA. Just talk to us about your life as a member of the board of our, you know, our greatest ally, which is our Writers Guild, our union. Talk to us about why you decided to get involved and what you're doing now.
I got involved because I was already involved. One of the things was like back in 2007, right before the writer's strike. When the writer's strike happened, I kind of already saw where the digital media, the new media was going, because I was already in it. I was already doing it. And even though that wasn't even part of the guild, that wasn't part of, you know, it was already, I would say, you know, it was part of the discussions that were happening. And the big reason why the strike occurred was because our union saw the future, and the studios tried to play it like, no, don't worry about that. Right. We're never going to do anything with that. Right. But what happened the day after the strike ended, they launched Hulu was launched. Right. So they already knew. They already knew these lying motherfuckers. It's like, so, I actually went out and I supported the writers, you know, members of the guild, and I marched and in front of gates for 101 days. Every day I was there, I made mm-hmm. friends, and I got to learn more about like what a guild member is and what the union and who they represent, and after that, every show that I was on, I was normally the captain. And the captain for a show is the person mm-hmm. that is sort of the point person that gets the information from mm-hmm. leadership, from membership, of basically being able to share that and keeping everybody, aware of what's going on, right?
Yep, you were the captain on Scream as well. Yep,
yeah,
I remember.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so it was around that time where I got approached and saying like, hey, you're an active member. People, seem to listen to you, seem to look up to you, or seem to respond to you. You should run for the board. And at first I was like, no, but then, I started looking at sort of, again, the lay of the land and realizing like, yeah, there need to be more voices like myself, especially the POCs, because there weren't there were hardly any POCs on the board. So I was like, all right, can I do this? And I ran the first time, and I ran with my colleagues, David Slack, Ashley Gable, Patty Carr. We ran as a slate, and I ended up getting elected and being a part of the board. Because the other thing was seeing the future of like where things were going that I wanted to be a part of, which was basically the contract negotiations between the agencies as well as the studios. Those were the two biggest fights that were coming up at that point in time. And I knew I didn't want to be on the sidelines.
Right.
And I said, I want to be a part of that. I want to lend my voice to that. And so that's where I just rolled up my sleeves and got in there and been working with tremendously smart people, very smart. And they're all writers, because it's like, as the board, we're not a separate entity. We are members of the guild, and I think that's in itself is so important to understand. It's like, even though I'm a board, a board member, I'm also, I'm a writer first and foremost. And as are my colleagues.
I think that's the part to me that's really fascinating about it, Derek. It's like, I think, and for those who don't know or whatever, all of us are members of the Writers Guild. I mean, the Writers Guild of America, East and West, both represents, writers in our industry and fights on behalf of, everything from pay to diversity, equity, and inclusion issues.
To our health insurance. That's the big one. Yeah. The health insurance. Yeah.
Health insurance. All of it. We have some of the best health insurance, in the industry.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
Yes. And and in a world in the U.S. where I think less than 10% of the American workforce is represented by a union or something crazy like that. Maybe it's not that low. I mean, but it's not a lot. The unions have been busted, as we know, over several decades. So I think it's just such an important thing to mention that this is not like, this is something that you saw as part of your duty as a writer.
Yes.
That's involved. That's also a member of a workforce. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, it's like, definitely I saw it as a part of my duty. And I also felt like that, again, in that word, pay it forward, give back. I said, I want to be a part of something that allows us to continue to be writers in this business, and then seeing the next generation of writers that come up, because again, it's like our strength are in the numbers, and so we got to make sure that we take care of those that come next. And again, following in the footsteps of people that, that did the exact same thing to allow me to be in the opportunities benefit, from, again, if the 2007 strike didn't happen, we would not be getting the residuals from, or getting the pay that we're getting, working in stream, and for those that work in streaming now, right?
Right.
It's like,
which is everybody, because everything eventually goes to streaming. Exactly. So like, we're all working for streaming, whether we chose to or not. Everything eventually streams.
if everything is eventually streaming again, because the studio saw where it was going and tried it. And it's the same way that, you know, where it was video tapes, you know, video cassettes and DVDs, you know, all that stuff was like the technology that was changing the landscape. But it's like, this is where we are now, where every show is streaming, right? And there's like, so there's more, never have we been in a time where there are more shows on the air and more opportunities, but at this, you know, it's like, we're still so far behind in what we should be justly compensated as writers.
Well, on that, and you're alluding to it, this is just my last question. I don't know if Sherman has any on the guilt stuff. You're alluding to it. Look, just really quick for people out there, what are the sort of like 1, 2, 3 top things that the guild and we as workers in the guild should be concerned about going forward?
Think the big ticket items, because unfortunately, because, you know, this past year with the negotiations with the studios that we had, this sort of, you know, while there were some gains made, but at the real, you know, the reality of it being in the middle of a pandemic, it's like, and people just trying to hold it together to work. There were some gains that, you know, we didn't get. And I think a big part of that was, you know, for feature writers. Feature writers did not get, you know, it was a hard battle, but they, you know, it was like the studios, you know, knocked everything down that we were trying to gain for feature writers. That in itself, I think, is going to be a big issue in the next 3 years, where, you know, we keep saying it's like, we don't have to wait those 3 years. We got to do everything we can. But I think in the next, you know, negotiations, that will be a big topic will be a focus.
And just real quick, I want to people who are listening and might not understand, the reason why you're saying next 3 years is because every few years, a predetermined amount of time, usually 3 years, we sign a new contract with the studios and the producers. And every 3 years, it comes back up for renegotiation. And that's our best chance as a collective body to get new gains and fight for new things as we go into a new contract.
Including health and pension, you know, while we're solvent now, you know, it's going to be, again, come the 3 years, like, what's going to happen? Because look at the landscape of the world in general, right? Of like how, you know, things, no one could foresee that there was going to be a pandemic, you know, and it's like, but we're able to say, you know, thanks to, you know, that people are going to be able to, you know, be taken care of. And we got to make sure that we are able to take care of our writers going forward. And everybody that's a member, there just needs to be better compensation for writers across the board. You know, studios take, and they will continue to try and take as much as possible and try to justify why they don't have to pay as much as possible, right? They will find ways. I'm not saying that the studios are just objectively evil. I'll just say corporations are. it's just like, you know, the greed, right? It's just like the endless greed. But, you know, they will say like, well, it's costing us this much money. And then it's like, but at the same time, we'll find ways to say like, well, we're not going to pay you. It's just a frustrating way of doing business. And then, you know, you're seeing that there's a certain, you know, section that benefits tremendously off the works of us as writers, as the ones that it's like, this town would not operate at all if a writer didn't exist. But yet they will, they will do everything they can to make sure that we feel like that we are the least important component.
Right.
We have to fight against that. We have,
they could figure out a structure where you got no money up front, they would definitely do that. It's a theme that we talk about a lot on this show, which is and we're going to keep talking about it because it's very prevalent, which is the constant disrespect of just screenwriters and television writers in general. But with that said, we're going to have to leave it there. Derek, this has been an amazing talk. We learned so much from you. I think that people are going to be really interested in your story because it's not really a story. We've not had a story like this yet on our podcast and his journey to actually becoming a professional writer. So I hope that everybody enjoyed it. And I hope you take those jewels that he dropped, man, because there were a lot in there. I hope you take them, stash them away, and use them when you have to. But right now, we have to go. We must go to everybody's favorite segment, which is Don't Do That Shit. A little place where we tell you, give you a little advice, how to write, how to live your life as a screenwriter, how to make your career function by telling you what not to do. Everybody else has the positive things telling you what you should do. We're going to tell you exactly what not to do. So here we go. I'd like to invite our guest, Derek. If you have a don't do that shit for this week, you are welcome to go first. And you also don't have to participate if you don't want to.
No, I think I don't. And, you know, I haven't heard I haven't had a chance to listen to the rest of your amazing podcast episodes here. But we'll say the last episode you were talking about, and I think it was something that sparked in me where it was like thinking about it. It's like, oh yeah, the one thing I would say, the cardinal sin of being a writer and a writer's room, especially a young writer, do not be a contrarian. Do not be a contrarian.
That's a good one.
It's like you can disagree, but as my old boss used to say, and you know, a lot of people will attest to, is like, you better come back with a reason why you disagree. You can't just say like, no, I don't like something, and then just leave it like that. You can't you can't drop a no grenade in the middle of the room and walk out. Like that's not, you know, you don't have that prerogative, especially as a young writer. Now, as a showrunner, absolutely. You can do whatever you want. You can be like, I don't like that, and not tell the reason why. Of course, you might not be liked, but, you know, at the same time, it's like sometimes you don't have a reason. You know, you don't have time to explain that. But that's another lesson that showrunners, you know, which like you should always be able to come back and say like why you don't like something, not just blow something up. But that's a whole other discussion. But I will say I think that would be a very big rule, is like, as you're starting out, do not be the person that is always saying like, nope, I don't like that. Nah, that doesn't sit with me. Unless you actually have a reason why. You have to have an idea. It goes hand in hand.
You know, I always hear this is a close cousin to what you're saying. I think it's actually what you're saying, but I always hear, don't pitch problems, pitch solutions, you know, which means like, if you have a problem with something, just phrase it in what your idea is to get the story where it needs to be, or to overcome the problem that the room's up against. So I think that's actually really excellent advice. Actually, listen, I know the showrunners are sort of mythical beings who can do what they want, but I would also say showrunners take that advice too. Don't just tell me what,
for real.
Don't just tell me what's wrong with my script. Tell me how we're going to fix it. So like, everybody should take that advice. Nobody's above getting this. Don't do that shit. Nobody.
Yeah.
Everybody can get it. Love that. Right. Great advice. Yeah. Thank you for that. Derek, Shu, do you have a don't do that shit for this week?
I do. It's a very lazy don't do that shit, because it is a repeat.
Oh, no.
But I think it bears repeating because, and I hope it's cool if I say this, Sherman, but it came right after we did a don't do that shit, where we mentioned, and I believe it was AKB. I can't remember which show it was, whether it was one of us or one that we did with AKB. But the don't do that shit we did was do not direct on the page.
Yes.
And right after that, you forwarded me something from a screenwriting group that I won't mention, that gave the direct opposite advice floating around. And I just felt the need to repeat this don't do that shit, because I don't know who these people are giving. Look, there's a lot of contrary advice, but this one is like, there's not a question. Do not direct on the page. Don't do it. Don't angle on, push through this. I mean, there may be some very specific instances in which you need to do that.
Sparingly.
Sparingly, maybe. But do not do that don't do that shit as a rule. You're not the director. You're a writer. And this is a script to be read. This is a script don't direct on the page. The other element to that is that, which I think is somewhat valid, but people feel the need to sort of carry the reader's hand through the process of reading the script, and then to indicate the emotions of the characters throughout the script in action description. I would mostly say, don't do that shit either. That is a form of directing on the page. If you can't see it, don't put it in the action description. There is, I think when you get to a certain point, yes, there are rules that you can break, but I would not advise that to anybody unless in some very, very specific, small circumstances where you need to say, this is the moment she has feared for her entire life in an action description line or something. But please, for God's sake, don't direct on the page. Don't direct feelings on the page. Don't do that shit.
Yes, and I will actually, I'll add on to that, which is to say, be careful who you take advice from. And this was a good example of somebody just throwing out advice and like it's bad advice. Please listen to episode 10 of our podcast where we talk about the screenwriting advice industry and why you should be very, very skeptical in some corners. And this was a great example. My don't do that shit, very, very quick, which is don't do this shit. Don't write the pilot of your series and then write more episodes of it. I see a lot of people, man, who are like, I have a great idea for a show. And then don't contradict me yet. Don't contradict me yet. I already hear you gearing up to disagree. I know that we all binge watch shows. And so we feel like we have watched this 10 episode complete story. And when you get an idea for a story, for a series, you want to tell that complete, story. There really is no reason to do that, especially if you're an aspiring writer. Using that time to write another pilot for another show would be much, much more beneficial. Then you have two pilot episodes you can show people, as opposed to one series, right, where you've written several episodes. If the producers, the agents, the people reading it don't like your pilot, they're never going to read episode 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. They're gonna tell you, I like your writing, but I'm not reading more of this series. Wouldn't it be great if you could hand them another pilot episode to another series that might spark with them? Why waste your time writing multiple episodes? Don't write multiple episodes of a series unless somebody has contracted you to do it. Otherwise, the pilot is enough. Don't do that shit. Don't write multiple episodes. Okay, Shakri, come with your wrong contradiction.
Once you finish, I basically agree. I do agree. I have one scenario, and I don't want to mention his name, but I will ask him offline between episodes. That a person that I know who wrote all 10 episodes of a show and then sold that.
But was he an established writer?
First timer. That's how he broke in.
No.
And no. But he, and, I, can't, I don't believe I want to talk to him.
And his name was David Milch.
Yeah, David Milch is the only one who could do that.
He did. Hey, it sold. It was produced. I don't think he is. I'm not going to say the name of the show because I need to get his permission. We'll stay tuned. But I don't know. Here's the reason I agree with you, because I don't know that he would say that he would ever do that again, because I don't know that he had a bad experience. And I think he rethinks that decision.
I feel like that's the exception that proves the rule. You know what I mean? Like, I think, like,
yes,
there's always an exception that proves the rule in this business.
Yes.
I will say,
doesn't mean you should do it.
I will say that, you know, to piggyback on what you're saying, is like this town, especially, you know, it's built on what else you got. Because it's not about what you write today that might land you that job. It's what you write tomorrow that's going to, you know, get that gig for you. So it's like people, like, you know, you take a meeting and they'll be like, I read your script. This is fantastic. What else you got? And if you say like, well, I have this other thing here. It's a, you know, a Western with dragons in it. They're like, oh, and next thing you know, you're selling your show with a Western with dragons in it. Note to self, write that down.
The Western with dragons.
Right? It's like, so that's the, you know, that's the thing. It's always about what else you got. And especially even when you're established, it's like, oh, you're working on something? Yeah. Okay. Well, what else you got?
Totally agree. There's no other. I totally agree. Even with that exception, I totally, totally agree.
Yeah. Love it.
You want to wrap it up, Sean?
Yeah, let's wrap it up, guys. Derek, again, it's been a pleasure. And now I think it's time to call it quits. You have been listening to The Diversity Hires. You can find us across all social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We are at Div Hires Pod. I'm your host, Sherman Payne.
And I am Shukri Hassan Tillman, a.k.a. Shu. This show is produced by the wonderful August K. Burton, a.k.b. He'll be back on the show soon, I'm sure. Listen, find us anywhere that you find podcasts. Like Sherman said, you can find us online at thediversityhires.com. You can write to us and tell us what you'd like to hear on the podcast. Give us shout outs. You know, we always love those notes where you just tell us how great we are and how much you really love listening to the podcast. That's good too. But you can also give us criticism. You can tell us something that we didn't quite cover that you need to hear, suggestions for guests, anything of the like. But most importantly, please share the podcast with everybody you know. Share, share, share. We're trying to build up our listener base. You can reach us, of course, on all the social media platforms at Div Hires Pod is our handle. We will see you next week with another exciting episode and probably another exciting guest on the Diversity Hires. See you next week.
Peace.